Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants' lines are in listen-only mode until the question-answer of today's sessions. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. This conference is also being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect your line at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jackie Glaze. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome everyone to today's Allstate call. I'll now turn to Amory Costello, our Acting Center Director, and she will introduce our guest speakers and share highlights for today's discussion. Amory?
Thank you very much, Jackie, and welcome to everyone, and thank you for joining us today. I'd like to take a moment and acknowledge the leadership transition happening here at CMCS. As Calder Lynch mentioned a few weeks ago, he's now the acting chief of staff to Administrator Seema Verma. And as of today, I'm the acting director for CMCS. I'm really very excited about this opportunity and especially my ability to continue to work with you as we work together to collaboratively run the Medicaid and CHIP programs. But now, turning to our call today, we're joined by Steve Perina, the Deputy Group Director in CMS's Center for Program Integrity, who will discuss their plans to resume MEQC and PERM Corrective Action Plan-related activity. We'll also hear from CMCS staff about an informational bulletin released yesterday that describes reimbursement strategies available to states that want to implement specific infection control practices, like designating a quarantine or isolation wing for COVID-19 patients in nursing facilities. This is critically important given how we know nursing facilities were particularly vulnerable to the prevalence and spread of COVID-19. Before those presentations, we'll hear from Will Chang, Brenna Jenny, and Laura Schatz-Snyder from the HHS Office of the General Counsel. Will serves as the Deputy General Counsel. Brenna also serves as Deputy General Counsel and Chief Legal Officer for CMS, and Laura is an attorney in our General Counsel's office. Our OGC colleagues will provide an overview of an amendment to the PREP Act declaration that allows pharmacists to administer vaccines to children. As you may have seen, immunization data from the CDC show that routine pediatric vaccinations have dropped off considerably during the public health emergency related to COVID-19. There are a number of reasons that potentially explain this decline, including changes in healthcare access as a result of temporary practice closures, social distancing, concern about virus exposure during well-child visits, and other COVID-19 mitigation strategies. In order to ensure that all children can receive necessary vaccinations to prevent outbreaks of childhood illnesses, eligible state-licensed pharmacists and pharmacy interns have been given authority to administer vaccines to children ages 3 through 18, as long as specific requirements have been met. We understand that after listening to this overview, you will likely have operational questions specific to Medicaid and CHIP. We are working on developing some FAQs related to Medicaid and CHIP provider enrollment requirements, requirements related to the Vaccines for Children's program, and implications for states with managed care. We welcome your questions today, but may need to follow up further in a future Allstate call with additional information. Before turning things over to OGC, I also want to take a moment to highlight that August is also National Immunization Awareness Month. This year is especially timely to spread awareness about the importance of pediatric vaccines because of the drop in routine pediatric immunizations that I just noted. It is critical that children continue to be immunized during the public health emergency so that there are no increases in preventable childhood diseases. The HHS Office of the Assistant Secretary for Health, the Centers for Disease Control, and the National HPV Roundtable have just released toolkits focusing on the importance of pediatric vaccines as well as National Immunization Awareness Month. We'll be sending out an email tomorrow to share these resources with you. I also want to take an opportunity to note that as the United States continues to fight COVID-19, it is particularly important to be protected from flu by getting the seasonal flu vaccine. We encourage states to start thinking early about their flu vaccination campaigns. HHS will soon be releasing additional information focusing on the importance of the flu vaccine. We'll highlight those materials for you as they become available. With that, I'd like to turn the call over to Will Chang to start OGC's presentation. Will?
Thank you, Anne-Marie, and congratulations on your promotion. And thank you all on the call for this opportunity to talk with you about the Secretary's most recent amendment to his declaration under the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act, also known as the PREP Act. As many of you know, the PREP Act is a federal statute that allows the Secretary to confer broad liability immunity to designated persons who use designated medical countermeasures. Examples of such countermeasures include COVID-19 tests that the FDA has approved, licensed, or authorized, similarly, therapeutics and other FDA-approved devices. Now, the PREP Act preempts any state legal requirements that differ from or is in conflict with the Secretary's declaration. So what that means is that the Secretary, under the PREP Act, may authorize persons to use and administer covered countermeasures, even if state law does not allow such persons to perform those services. Now, the Secretary has previously used this authority on a topic that we've discussed with this group, and that involves licensed pharmacists ordering and administering FDA-authorized COVID-19 tests. And for the reasons that Emory already discussed, the Secretary recently amended his PREP Act declaration to authorize state licensed pharmacists and pharmacy interns who are licensed or registered with the State Board of Pharmacy and operating under the supervision of the state licensed pharmacists to administer certain vaccines to children ages 3 through 18. So the pharmacists can order and administer such vaccines, and the pharmacy interns may administer those vaccines when acting under the supervision of the pharmacists. There are conditions attached to the authorization. The vaccine must be approved or licensed by the Food and Drug Administration. The vaccination must be ordered and administered according to CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices immunization schedules. The licensed pharmacist must complete a practical training program of at least 20 hours that is approved by the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education. This training program must include hands-on injection technique, clinical evaluation of indications and contraindications of vaccines, and the recognition and treatment of emergency reactions to vaccines. The licensed or registered pharmacy intern must complete a practical training program that is approved by the ACPE. This training program must include hands-on injection technique, clinical evaluation of indications and contraindications of vaccines, the recognition and treatment of emergency reactions to vaccines. Both the licensed pharmacist and the licensed or registered pharmacy intern must have a current certificate in basic cardiopulmonary resuscitation. The licensed pharmacist must complete a minimum of 2 hours of ACPE-approved immunization-related continuing pharmacy education during each state licensing period. The licensed pharmacist must comply with record-keeping and reporting requirements of the jurisdiction where he or she administers vaccines, and that includes informing the patient's primary care provider when available, submitting the required immunization information to the state or local immunization information system, also known as the vaccine registry, complying with requirements with respect to reporting adverse events, and complying with requirements whereby the person administering the vaccine must review the vaccine registry or other vaccination records before administering the vaccine. Now, the licensed pharmacist, to receive PREP Act coverage, the licensed pharmacist must also inform his or her childhood vaccination patients and the adult caregivers accompanying the children of the importance of a well child visit with a pediatrician or other licensed primary care provider and refer patients as appropriate in his amendment to his PREP Act declaration. And the Secretary again reemphasizes the importance of making these well child visits with the pediatrician and primary care physician and highlights all the steps that the providers are taking during the COVID-19 pandemic to ensure a safe environment for children to meet their well child visits. Laura?
Thanks, Will. So I'm going to speak a little bit to what all of this means for purposes of Medicaid reimbursement. So as I'm sure you're all aware, states are required to cover administration of vaccines for most Medicaid-eligible children in the age group that is covered by this recent amendment to the PREP Act Declaration under the Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnostic, and Treatment, or EPSDT benefit. Additionally, states are required to ensure that Medicaid beneficiaries can receive Medicaid-covered services from the qualified and willing provider of their choice. So the PREP Act Declaration Amendment makes pharmacists and pharmacy interns who meet all the conditions in the declaration that Will just summarized qualified to administer vaccines to children aged 3 through 18, and it does so regardless of any state law to the contrary. So accordingly, HHS will expect state Medicaid programs to reimburse pharmacies if their qualified staff pharmacists order and administer, and their pharmacy interns administer, childhood vaccines to Medicaid-eligible children consistent with the amended declaration. And HHS and CMS expect this even if, absent the amended declaration, state or local scope of practice laws would not permit the pharmacist or the pharmacy intern to carry out these tasks. States still must meet all other applicable federal requirements, such as reimbursing only those providers that are enrolled as Medicaid providers. Nothing in this recent amendment to the PREP Act Declaration affects the federal requirement in 42 CFR Part 455, Subpart E, regarding the screening and enrollment of Medicaid providers. So that is the top line upshot for Medicaid reimbursement purposes.
Thank you, Laura, and thank you, Will. Are you finished with your presentation? Or are we ready to take questions?
We are.
Okay, great, great. Okay, so we'll now open up the phone line so that the audience can ask questions of Will, Laura, and Brenna. And so, operator, please open up the phone lines.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly. Your name is required to introduce your question. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. It will take a few moments for questions to come through. Please stand by. I am currently showing no questions. Again, as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Stand by a moment. Our first question comes from John Ross. John, your line is open.
Hi, I'm John Ross from Indiana Medicaid. Similar to a question I've asked in the past, with regards to the pharmacists, will the pharmacists need to be enrolled as a individual provider, or will the pharmacy's NPI and enrollment be sufficient?
So this is Laura. Jackie, did you want to take that, or?
Laura, you can certainly answer the question.
So I think this is one of the areas that you should expect to see some additional guidance or direction on from CMS, unless there are others on this call who would like to discuss it.
Laura, this is Amy Lepsky. So that's right. We are working on some FAQs that are going to focus more on these operational considerations, knowing that, you know, states will want some more specifics regarding enrolling pharmacists versus pharmacies.
Thank you.
Thank you, John, for that question. It's very helpful as we develop the FAQs.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Jessica Dresner. Jessica, your line is now open.
Thank you. I'm calling from MoHealthNet, the state Medicaid agency in Missouri. And I apologize. I really did have the same question as John with just a little bit more to it, and I was speaking with the operator, so I may have missed part of the discussion around this. But my question was, A, same as John's, can we, you know, pay the pharmacy if they're the enrolled practitioner, or does the individual pharmacist need to be enrolled? But part B to that, as you're developing the FAQs, if you could help us out with just a little bit more to that, would it be sufficient if the pharmacy is enrolled that the pharmacist is the performing provider, understanding if that's the expectation, he or she would have to still be enrolled, but would it be all right for the pharmacy to be the billing provider and the pharmacist to be the performing provider? And then just back to the original question, can we just have the pharmacy be the performing and billing provider both without the pharmacist being enrolled? So look forward to those FAQs. Thank you for that.
Thank you for the question.
Yes.
Next question comes from Judy Moore Peterson. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thank you so much for all this information. It's very helpful. My questions are regarding the timing of this. We can enroll, or we can have the pharmacist enrolled. I know in our systems we have it set up so that only certain kinds of claims can come in from that, and we would only pay the provider for certain kinds of claims. And that's in our system, but then being a managed care state, we also have to have, you know, get this information out to all the managed care plans, et cetera. So my questions are around timing, and then timing of the FAQs, et cetera, and how we'll be able to make this happen. And this is only for the time of the emergency, or is it related to just in general? And I apologize. You probably said that, and I just missed it.
Yeah. So, Laura, let me take the first two parts of that question. And thank you for those questions, Judy. They're very important. You did not miss it. This authorization is effective so long as the PREP Act is effective, which boiled down is so long as there is an emergency, public health emergency under the PREP. And to your second question on timing, while I cannot answer the operational nuances, that's not my wheelhouse, this PREP Act declaration now amended, from a legal perspective, all the legal authorities that we just discussed are effective as of today.
Thank you.
I defer to others on those operational questions.
And Judy, we do have your questions, and we will continue to work through those because we understand it's important that you get some feedback very quickly. So we have your questions, and we will certainly follow up as quickly as possible.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
The final question we have in queue comes from Eve Lickers. Eve, your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for this information on the pharmacist. Our question kind of also, I think, lends itself to the last inquirer and the fact that, you know, pharmacists currently in Pennsylvania can administer vaccines, and it's not just limited to these that are with the children. And we're looking to add these to the state plan. And so currently right now, when we talk about pharmacies, we talk about prescribed drugs. That's the category of service that is identified. So obviously that's where we're identifying payment to the pharmacies. So we're looking at how would we actually identify this in the plan and how, you know, what is CMS's recommendation, and also how would this be reported on the CMS 64?
This is Kirsten Jensen from CMS, and we will take those questions back as well and work on getting guidance out on those topics.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yep.
We can take one additional question, and then we'll move on to our next speaker. Do we have any questions still in the queue?
That was the last question we had in queue.
Okay, great. Thank you. And so, again, want to thank Will and Laura for your presentations and answering the questions that we had from the audience. So now we'll move on to Steve Farina, and he's going to provide an update on CPI's resumption of the MEQC and PERM cap. So, Steve?
Great. Thank you, Jackie. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Steve Farina, and I'm a Deputy Group Director in our Center for Program Integrity. I wanted to just give a brief overview of two recent announcements that we've made regarding the PERM and MEQC programs. Many of you are probably very familiar with these programs already, but just by way of level setting, the PERM program estimates Medicaid and CHIP improper payment rates both nationally and at a state level, and it also identifies the drivers of errors and the related corrective actions. And the MEQC program operates during states' off-cycle PERM years to help states address beneficiary eligibility errors in particular that were identified during the PERM review. So starting with the PERM program, a few weeks ago, my colleagues in the Office of Financial Management provided an update to you all about their resumption of the PERM measurement activities. So we in the Center for Program Integrity have also resumed our PERM corrective action plan work with the states. We've already been in contact with each of the cycles of states, but I just wanted to give a quick summary of the current status of each of their PERM cap updates. So for cycles 1 and 3 from their most recent PERM review years, we've re-engaged reviews of those submitted caps from earlier this year, and our goal is to work with those states to get them finalized in the near future. And then our routine oversight work of those caps will continue going forward until their next PERM review. And for cycle 2, which will have their improper payment rates reported this November, we understand the significant impacts that COVID-19 has had on state operations. So we're providing some flexibilities for cycle 2 states specifically as they develop their caps. So the biggest flexibility for cycle 2 states is that we're implementing a summary level cap requirement that will cover the main drivers of the national PERM rate instead of the state-specific PERM rates. And we're going to be holding a kickoff call with cycle 2 states in November to go over these flexibilities in greater detail. In terms of the MEQC program, we announced last week that we're implementing various COVID flexibilities for cycles 1 and 2 that I just wanted to draw your attention to. So just by way of background, cycle 1 states under MEQC were conducting their reviews during 2019 and were set to report their results of their reviews this summer. And cycle 2 states are conducting their MEQC reviews this year and are set to report their results next year. So for both cycles 1 and 2, we're implementing reduced reporting requirements for their case level reports and corrective action plans. So states will only have to report high level, summary level information for their case level reports and their corrective action plans. We're also providing an extension for submitting these documents. We're extending the deadlines to November 1st of this year for cycle 1 and November 1st of next year for cycle 2. And finally, we're also not requiring either cycles 1 or 2 to conduct the payment reviews that they would normally have conducted to identify and return overpayments as a result of the MEQC pilots. So in addition to those flexibilities, for cycle 2 only, we're also reducing their sample size from 800 cases to 200 cases to provide some additional flexibility. So I'm happy to answer any questions you all have about these changes at the end of this call, or you can also reach out to your PERM cap and MEQC points of contact here at CMS. And so with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Amy Lutsky, to cover the next topic.
Thanks so much, Steve. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Amy Lutsky, and I'm the Acting Deputy Director in the Children and Adult Health Programs Group. We have been working in partnership with Steve and other colleagues in the Center for Program Integrity to develop a webinar discussing program integrity strategies for Medicaid and CHIP eligibility. This webinar on program integrity is scheduled for next week on Monday, August 31st, from 2 to 3:30 p.m. This is actually part of the CMCS Coverage Learning Collaborative that many of you on today's call are already probably familiar with. The Coverage LC provides a forum for CMS and states to examine eligibility and enrollment requirements and develop tools and guidance to support state efforts. The webinar this Monday will cover specifically Medicaid and CHIP program integrity basics, the relationship between program integrity and eligibility processes, the CMCS informational bulletin that was put out last year on oversight of state claiming and program integrity expectations, as well as ensuring accurate eligibility determinations and claiming of FMAP, program oversight monitoring, and will also feature examples of highly effective program integrity practices in states. Accurate eligibility determination may not traditionally be considered program integrity, but it is a vital aspect of a program integrity strategy. So this webinar will really focus on accurate eligibility determinations as being a front line for strengthened program integrity efforts. Invitations were sent last week to all state Medicaid directors, CHIP directors, and state program integrity officials. Please register and encourage your eligibility staff to register as well. If this email sounds vaguely familiar, but you're thinking it might be buried in your inbox, we are also planning to send out another email through the CMCS listserv very soon. So please be on the lookout for that. Thank you. I think that's back to you, Jackie.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you, Steve. We're now moving on to Amber McCarroll, and she's going to provide an update of the Nursing Home Informational Bulletin. Amber?
Hi, thank you, Jackie. Yesterday, we released a CMCS informational bulletin to remind states of the available flexibilities that can be used to enhance Medicaid payments to nursing facilities during this public health emergency in order to support the facility's ability to safely care for its residents. Through the SIB, we're encouraging states to use these payment flexibilities to support any necessary actions to slow the further spread of COVID-19 in nursing homes, such as isolation or quarantine of residents. As everyone is now very familiar with the Medicaid Disaster Relief SPA template that was released early in March, one of the key authorities that we have approved through this SPA template has been to increase Medicaid payments to nursing facilities. The SIB highlights a variety of ways that the states can use or have used the Disaster Relief SPA in order to increase Medicaid payments to nursing facilities, including the recognition of additional Medicaid costs associated with increased staffing and personal protective equipment needed, and also targeting payment increases to nursing facilities that are either treating residents diagnosed with COVID-19 or to nursing facilities that are located in geographic areas that have experienced an outbreak. The SIB also highlights initiatives that have already been implemented by three states, Ohio, Michigan, and Iowa, to improve care and mitigate the spread of COVID-19. We are going to have a more in-depth presentation on some of those initiatives on a later call, so I'm just going to, for now, share a high-level overview. Excuse me. Ohio provides tiered Medicaid payments to certain nursing facilities based on an individual resident's need for isolation or quarantine. The payments differ based on whether quarantine or isolation is necessary, and it's also based on patient acuity. Instead of designating certain nursing homes as COVID-only, Ohio allows nursing facilities to designate specific sections of the facility for quarantine or isolation, which enables residents to remain in their home facility. Michigan increased Medicaid payment rates for certain nursing facilities that the state has designated as a COVID-19 regional hub. These facilities are solely dedicated to serving COVID-19 patients. The facilities receive an upfront payment of $5,000 per bed in the first month to address staffing needs and infrastructure changes necessary. After that first month, the nursing facilities receive an additional payment of $200 per resident per day. In Iowa, the state is providing special COVID-19 relief rate payments to nursing facilities that either have a designated isolation unit for COVID-19 treatment or that have been designated as a COVID-19 only facility. These payments are an add-on payment of $300 per day to eligible nursing facilities for each resident in one of the designated units who is discharged from the hospital to the nursing facility and who is COVID-19 positive or who has a COVID-19 test result pending. The SIB also includes a reminder about the funds that are available for the, through the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Securities, the CARE Act, and the Paycheck Protection Program and Healthcare Enhancement Act, in which the federal government has allocated $175 billion in payments to be distributed through the Provider Relief Fund to support healthcare-related expenses or lost revenue that are attributable to the COVID-19 pandemic. These payments do not need to be repaid to the government if the providers comply with the terms and conditions of receiving those payments. And with that, I'm going to turn the mic over to John Giles, who will briefly discuss some of the payment flexibilities that are available to states with managed care delivery systems.
Thanks, Amber, and good afternoon, everyone. In states that have a managed care delivery system and are interested in enhancing specific payments for nursing facilities, states can direct specific payments made by managed care plans to providers through a state-directed payment. As we've provided previously on other Allstate calls, states can include contractual requirements for their managed care plans to pay a specific minimum fee schedule or a specific uniform dollar or percentage increase for a class of providers, including for nursing facilities. We published guidance previously on May 14th that was intended to help states comply with the regulatory requirements for state-directed payments in response to COVID-19 and provided a framework that will help states design these payment arrangements and facilitate CMS's review and approval process, including an example preprint template. For states that are seeking to utilize the flexibilities described in the May guidance, states will need to follow the framework provided, including the implementation of a two-sided risk mitigation strategy. If states need any technical assistance on state-directed payments, please reach out, and we'd be happy to discuss any issues with you. As an alternative approach to implementing state-directed payments, some states have had a preference for implementing these enhanced payments as non-risk payment arrangements for COVID-related services. As part of this SIB, we confirm that states can consider paying for services outside of the managed care capitation rates as a non-risk payment arrangement. This arrangement can be structured as either a separate non-risk contract with your managed care plans or as an amendment to existing managed care plan contracts to include a non-risk payment arrangement. States will need to be able to identify relevant costs and beneficiaries accurately within these contracts, and states would need to amend their contracts to clearly define the benefits that the plans must cover on a risk basis and the benefits that are excluded from the capitation rates and would be covered on a non-risk basis. States and their actuaries would also need to determine if a rate amendment is necessary to address any services previously included in capitation rate development that now need to be removed and paid on a non-risk basis. If states choose to amend their existing contract to include a non-risk payment, states would need to comply with the applicable upper payment limits for a non-risk contract. Jackie, I think I'm turning the call now back to you for any state questions on this topic.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Amber. So that concludes our presentations for today. So we're ready to open up the phone line so the audience can ask any questions of the presenters that you heard today or any other general questions that you may have for us. So, operator, please open the phone lines.
Thank you. We'll now begin the second question and answer session. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name clearly. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. We do have a question in queue. Fetz Beasley. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I just have a question for Steve. You said the kickoff for PERM will be November. Is there a kickoff for MEQC for a CAP?
Yeah, so we actually, this Thursday at, I believe it's 1:30, and my colleague Joel Truman's on, he can correct me if this is wrong. Thursday at 1:30, we'll be doing an all-state call with our MEQC states to give them an overview of this process and start getting them kind of worked into, depending on what cycle they're in, their next set of either reporting in November for cycle one, which includes their CAPS, or cycle three, they'll be submitting their pilot planning documents in November as well. But let me check. Joel, is there anything you want to add to that response?
No, I think you've got it. Basically, cycle one and two, they're summary reports. Now, instead of case-level reports, they'll be doing summary reports, and the due date for those have been pushed back from August 1st to November 1st. So the cycle two states don't really have to worry about submitting till November 1st, 2021. But we are expecting pilot planning documents from the cycle three states and the first round of summary reports from the cycle one states due on November 1st.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Nicole Phillips. Ms. Nicole, your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question around the PERM errors or PERM findings and the enhanced funding around the COVID enhanced funding. If what type of impacts can the states expect if there are PERM error findings with cases that were kept open per the policy? For example, there's a PERM finding for eligibility related to renewal, but we kept them open because of the FFCRA. Are there any impacts that the state should be expecting or concerned about?
So this is Steve Perina. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, I think in terms of like how PERM would classify these errors based on the Section 6008 requirements, I don't know that we have the right people on the line for that question right now. But I don't know, Amy or Sarah, is there anything that you think you have from like the CMCS policy side?
Yeah. Hi, this is Sarah DeLone. I think if a state is you know, CMS has put out the guide, right? You need to keep, if according to the CMS guidance, you need to keep somebody enrolled in order to comply with the 6008B3 continuous coverage requirement for the enhanced match. That would not be registered as a PERM error. That's an authorized retention of eligibility due to FCRA. Is that the question? Just would that be an error or not? Yeah. And the answer is would not be an eligibility error.
And Sarah, this is Anne-Marie. Maybe I would just add, I think there are a lot of permutations of the issues, right? What happens if the state changed their verification practices? What if they had a regulatory concurrence to extend timelines on certain things, right? I mean, some of those may or may not traditionally be considered PERM errors, and I think, you know, our team here, our eligibility and enrollment team, work very closely with the Office of Financial Management that oversees PERM, and will be working through those issues so that as PERM is reinstituted, our Office of Financial Management and the PERM reviewers have a good understanding of what's the acceptable practice in a state and expectations for states. So I think that's ongoing work that we'll be doing with our Office of Financial Management colleagues.
Yeah, and this is Steve. And just to clarify, from the MEQC perspective, which is run out of the Center for Program Integrity, that situation specifically about the renewal, that also would not be considered an error under MEQC. And we're planning to kind of work on some additional guidance and information on states, kind of like what Anne-Marie was just saying, to flesh out those permutations as well.
I'm showing no further questions in queue. So as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please star 1. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Showing no questions in queue.
Thank you. Anne-Marie, shall I turn it back to you?
Sure. Great. Thank you, Jackie. I just want to take a moment and thank everyone for joining us today. I especially want to thank our colleagues in the Office of General Counsel, Center for Program Integrity, and our CMCS colleagues for their presentations today. I think it was very useful information. I also think the questions that we received from the audience, while there were a number we were not able to answer, hearing those questions really helps us develop the most appropriate frequently asked questions. So stay tuned. We'll have more answers coming your way. Our next Allstate call will be held next Tuesday. I can't believe I'm going to say this, September 1st. Yes, next week is September already. The topic and invitation are forthcoming, so watch your email. And, of course, if you have any questions that come up between now and our next call, please feel free to reach out to any of us, or in particular, reach out to your state lead, and they'll make sure to funnel the questions up to us so we can start to address them in future Allstate calls. So, again, thank you for joining us today, and have a great afternoon.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please allow a moment of silence and stand by for your post-conference.